This is a top to a, you know, what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see,
yeah,
the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11, oh, 11,
and most of
11,
and amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes are going to be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up,
yeah,
all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is, if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Conversation Radio's Lean, Mean, and Green Show right here on The Horn. It's Foxed Up with John Fox, where we turn the conversation to conservation. Foxed Up is brought to you by B1 Louder Productions in Sydney, Australia, and CityNet, citynet.net. B1 Louder by ringing 877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-443-2366, or use your free minutes by dialing direct 304-6585. Host, the ranting, head-banging hippie, John Fox.
Hey, hey, everybody. Welcome aboard Foxed Up here for, it's a Thursday here in Australia. It might still be Wednesday where you are on this beautiful blue marble, such as it is. Welcome to The Horn, and brought to you as normal by Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. I seem to forget to do that at the top of the show. But welcome aboard, everyone. It's, I'm still processing all that stuff from Peter's show earlier. Got to be one of the most intense bits of radio I have witnessed in a very, very, very long time. But anyway, today's subject is by request from the chat room today to get into carbon trading, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But first, we have our track of the day, and how I've overlooked playing a track from this particular artist for this long, I don't exactly know. And I'll only just take it as a huge, huge oversight. Today we're going to do a bit of Australian music, and an amazing, amazing guitar player and a great little three-piece band, the John Butler Trio. Now, if you're not familiar with John Butler, John Butler is actually born in the United States, has been living here for most of his life, plays a 12-string acoustic guitar with a slide through a Marshall. Bass player plays both electric bass and stand-up double bass, an amazing drummer. And the track I'm going to play today is a track called Take. Now, not that the lyric really applies, but the title grabbed me, and you know, as the American people and the American taxpayer end up having to pay out of their pockets to bail out failed banking systems, the title of this struck me. The track is called Take, as I said before, and I just kind of feel that we're kind of always, you know, being ripped off by those that run the show. And I'm looking at, I just opened up the Sydney Morning Herald's business page, and we still got about an hour left in the trading day. And so far, you know, after all the gains yesterday from the big bailout, the Australian markets have taken a massive dive again today. We're down over 3% on the day. It gained 3.5% yesterday. All that's gone bye-bye. And I've been calling this for, I don't know, 18 months now. The big collapse was coming because what we've been doing has been unsustainable on so many levels. And I hate to say it, but I was right. And, you know, as George W. Bush and his little profiteers have kept their head in the bloody sand and gone, tax cuts, tax cuts, tax cuts. All we need is tax cuts. The average citizen ends up wearing this. And here in Australia, it's working people. I'm tired of the term working families because it's not just families, but working people in general, whether they have children or not, are being hammered at the moment as our interest rates go through the roof in another, you know, economy that was set into overdrive by the previous right-wing government. And it's becoming pretty well accepted in this country that the situation that we are in right now is, you know, just, it's been manipulated to turn into this. And I had made the call that, you know, sometime after the Christmas holidays this year, you know, that just passed, once the glow of the Christmas income dissipated, the old shit was going to hit the fan, and it's hitting the fan. And how long are average citizens going to have to bail out these people and lose all the time? Something's got to happen. Things have got to change in so many ways. But we'll, now that Bob's all set, you know, technology seems to not be liking him today. But that's all right. We deal with these things. The track today is this track called Take. Off of the John Butler Trio's third album called Three. It's from 2001, and you can find more information on John Butler at thejohnbutlertrio.com, and there's also a link to their MySpace page on today's show post at fox.headonradionetwork.com. So without further ado, listen to this, 12-string through a Marshall with a slide, and this drummer is something else, and it's a great open one room recording. If you paid attention to the show the other night, you'll get what I mean. So without further ado, Take from the John Butler Trio. Roll it, Bob.
Take. Thank you.
How's that for just on fire? I swear, sometimes a power trio just is the ultimate band format. There's just so much space for the guys to just really open up, and got to be some of at their actual website, you can go and stream footage from live gigs, and telling you, John Butler is just amazing. That band is incredible. They and it's all live. And one of the things, you know, we talk about Radiohead and Nine Inch Nails and whatnot, these bands that are breaking the mold as far as the record industry. John Butler is another one. He founded the label that he releases his material on, and he has then used that label and very, very smart business sense to release other Australian artists. The Waifs, which are another really good kind of folky blues thing, are on John Butler's label, and they do a lot of touring together, and he's created an alternate infrastructure to the major labels. And Johnny Butler has consistently won, you know, our local Grammy Awards thing multiple times. I think he was Male Artist of the Year this year, and, you know, he's just fantastic. Long dreadlocks, you know, sits down and plays, you know, beautiful, you know, weaved rugs on the stage, the whole thing. I just suggest grabbing anything from the John Butler Trio. It's serious, crank it up and start dancing kind of music. And like I said, johnbutlertrio.com. Check him out. And he has done quite well internationally. I imagine quite a few of you out there have heard him and might even own some of his stuff. It's not like I'm really giving exposure to an unknown. However, somehow, some way, I overlooked one of Australia's greatest homegrown talents. Okay. Like I said, by request, we're going to talk about carbon trading. Now, I don't claim to be an expert on this at all, because it's something that's still in development. It's something, the concept is still being melded, and we're dealing with something that could create great benefit, but, you know, anything that starts creating a market or a marketplace has the risk of, you know, going wrong. And we're going to revisit some links that I actually covered back, I think it was the 10th of January this year. I did a carbon trading story. So I've gone and pulled back a couple of these links. You know, they might be a couple months old, but the debate on this hasn't really changed much. I mean, this is this is still something that's in its that's kind of in an infantile state, shall we say. But something new that I found, I went hunting around, and from helium.com, carbon trading explained, and this is just from this is actually from the third article, and this kind of gives a bit of an idea of where carbon trading sits at the moment. And it says, carbon trading is all the rage amongst politicians trying to tackle climate change. The principle is very simple, is a very simple but clever mechanism which utilizes markets to price the cost of carbon in the economy. Companies who generate carbon emissions as outputs, as opposed to companies who generate emissions indirectly via their business inputs, the stuff they buy. The power companies and airlines are given a quota or permits. Permits can either be awarded or auctioned. The idea is that there is a fixed limit on the volume of emissions, and companies can trade their quotas. This means that companies who reduce their emissions below their quota can sell their surplus quota to another company who needs it to produce more. This has the effect of increasing the cost of carbon emissions and incentivizing companies to reduce their emissions. And the, you know, the basic idea behind this is to create a marketplace and put a price on carbon output. So for every ton of carbon that you produce, you actually have to pay for the damage done. The concept being a way to internalize what has for far too long been an externalized cost as far as business practices has been concerned. The European Emissions Trading System, ETS, handed out permits which simply had the effect of equalizing all companies' emissions at a given point, a snapshot, regardless of how efficient they are relative to each other, i.e., an inefficient company producing more emissions than a more efficient competitor is treated equally. They can then reduce their emissions by becoming more efficient and sell their surplus, while the already efficient company cannot benefit from their energy savings achieved before the permits were awarded. So this is one of the fundamental flaws in the EU design as it stands now. I agree with this opinion, but they're working on it. I think this is going to change. And you know, in the discussions before our election down here, when John Howard talked about an emissions trade cap and trade system here in Australia, his price for carbon was so small that it was not going to create the incentive for big polluters to cut back, to make changes. The carbon needs to be expensive, and it needs to be priced at such a rate that it creates an incentive for better environmental practice. They continue here. It says, auctioning is the most effective and fairest method of allocation, as this takes account of efficiency of companies. Efficient companies could bid a higher price than inefficient firms, and they could generate greater output, i.e. sell more product, within their emissions quota. If we are to take the issues of climate change seriously, then carbon trading has to be at the center of policy. It is no use taxing people off airplanes or off the road, as tax is a blunt instrument, but pricing carbon in the economy is the most effective and direct form of action because it targets emissions at its source. And I do agree with this. And this is something that we're still learning how to make work. And part of the idea is that then the carbon tax would be invested directly into new, cleaner, greener sources of power, would be invested in reforestation, would be invested in other things to help increase the carbon sink of the planet, to help deal with the carbon output that we are creating. And I think over time, this is my opinion, over time the price of carbon needs to become incrementally more expensive. And if you cannot make your business more efficient in line with a cap and trade scheme, that's not the public's problem. That is the business's problem. They need to act and stop getting away with ignoring the problem. And by putting a cost on the carbon that a business puts out, it shines a very, very clear light on their emissions. And some of the idea here is, if you're aware of the damage that's being done and it's hitting you where it counts in the back pocket, you are going to make changes in the way you do business. I think it's absolutely crucial to the long term system of actually getting cleaning up and becoming a carbon free economy in this world, and this is a global thing. And so, you know, this is the reason why you won't see, you know, George W. Bush anytime soon, or anyone that takes money from coal companies, really pushing for a serious cap and trade system. And I think the cap and trade system needs to be not only national at a national level, it needs to be at an international level. So the EU has made steps to doing this. It's not working as it should yet, but they have at least begun the process, and they will consistently fine-tune it and try and make it work. So, you know, anyone who says, you know, the carbon trading scheme in the EU didn't work, so bugger it. It's like, well, you know, just because your, you know, football team didn't win the championship this year doesn't mean you destroy the entire team. Next season, you try and build a better team. Bad sports analogy maybe, but works for me. Now I'm going to go back to a couple of links from one of the best blogs on the net when it comes to the environment, which is Celsius, CELSIAS.com. And they have they had a series of articles, the case for carbon trading, the case against carbon trading, and then another piece on whether or not the cap-and-trade systems just allow the big polluters to get away with murder and just, you know, be able to feel a little bit better about it. And so the case, we'll start with the case for carbon trading. And this goes back to January, but like I said, you know, this is a policy initiative that is still, you know, being developed, and very little has changed since this was written, and I just think it lays it out very well. Back in January of this year, Celsius published an interview with Kevin Smith of Carbon Trade Watch and Kuta Kill of Sinks Watch. In the interview, they laid out their argument against carbon trading in all its forms, claiming that it had not been and cannot be an effective tool in the fight against global warming. Shale Can, the writer, says, "I'm generally a proponent of carbon trading and have written about it on this blog a number of times. As such, I thought I would continue the discussion, providing the case for carbon trading and responding to Smith and Kill." I know I'm reading them kind of technically out of order, but that's my prerogative. "Let me first say, despite our disagreements in carbon trading, I hope we can recognize that we are both on the same side. We agree that climate change is an epic crisis that needs to be addressed immediately with drastic action. Where we disagree, I believe, is on the most effective, efficient, and feasible means by tackling climate change. But in the end, we want the same outcome. With that said, I'll start my response by summarizing the main points made by Smith and Kill. Please correct me, blah, blah, blah. One, the EU ETS, which is the EU's carbon trading system, Europe's carbon trading system under the Kyoto Protocol has been a failure and will continue as such. Two, carbon trading represents a privatization of the Earth's carbon cycling capacity without a democratic process to determine where to give emissions rights. Tree planting is an ineffective, potentially harmful means of reducing the planet's CO2, and carbon offsets reduce the need for our government to give us a different set of choices. And a better solution would be an amalgam of action ranging from local movement to a national government investment program to appropriate technology." And he takes on the first point of that the carbon trading system in Europe's been a failure. The first part of the argument that has the ETS has not achieved its goal so far, it is all but undeniable. Prices for carbon under the EU ETS dropped down just a few cents and have never made a real recovery. Few countries have reached their emissions targets to date, and the biggest polluters have reaped windfall profits from the free allocation of emissions allowances. And these are all spot-on points. "For anyone who's been involved in Kyoto, however, this has not come as a surprise, and not because they knew the EU ETS would fail, but because the first phase of the EU ETS, 2005 to 2007, was designed as a pilot phase, meant to work out the significant kinks in the system. Phase 2 of Kyoto just started last week," this is back in January, remember, "and offers substantial differences from the pilot phase. The World Business Council for Sustainable Development released an article the same day as our interview was published, outlining many of these differences. Two of these struck me as most relevant. First, the primary reason for the EU ETS failure in Phase 1 was an over-allocation of permits by a number of countries. And I do agree with this problem. In the early stages of the system, way too much leniency was given to the big polluters. And like I was saying before, if you're not hitting them hard enough, it's not going to be enough incentive to make proper changes. Second, emissions targets in Phase 1 were voluntary. Phase 2 brings with it the introduction of mandatory emissions targets with international enforcement. Admittedly, this enforcement will likely extend only as far as public reprimand, but that has been an effective tool on other global environment agreements. And so we are now only a couple of months into phase two, where there actually is some enforcement. Yes, it's still more just, you know, you, bad people. But, you know, public scrutiny can be very, very effective. He takes on point two about the privatization of the Earth's carbon cycling capacity. And this is where I think it needs to be somehow internationally regulated outside of the private sector. Now, how we do this, I'm still not sure. I think the only way it's going to happen is a voluntary, bad word. This is something that everyone just has to do. It has to be every nation involved in the cause for the greater good. Now, I know this is something that we haven't seen a whole hell of a lot of in the last couple of decades, but we've got no other choice. And he says here, to some degree, this is true. Introducing mandatory carbon trading like a cap-and-trade system places the onus on private industry. It forces polluters to do something to reduce their impact on the planet's carbon emissions, whether it is changing their own practices or helping finance projects to do so elsewhere. It is an important note that, as Eric Carlson of CarbonFund.org said on National Public Radio, we need a 70% or so reduction in emissions, and in fact, that's all the planet actually cares about. It doesn't matter where emissions reductions come from. 1 pound of CO2 in Bangladesh is 1 pound of CO2 in Poughkeepsie. So given the pressing nature of the crisis, we should be reducing our emissions in the places where we can reduce them the most, with clear cost to our livelihood, with the least cost to our livelihood and the planet's biodiversity. And this is all absolutely, absolutely spot on. And I do agree that it being a private initiative just makes it, rife and ready for abuse and people finding ways to get around it. But he says here, as to the lack of a democratic process, I'm not sure I understand this argument. The government in control of the cap and trade program maintains control of the overall cap, as well as the percentage of auction versus allocation. In any cap and trade scheme, these two sources of power give the government the ability to fundamentally alter the way cap and trade systems function. No, we don't have a voter referenda for every allocation, but if our elected officials design the system, is it not part of the democratic process? So, in other words, the people of any individual nation say, this is something we have to do. And like I've said before, I'm tired of people looking to elect leaders all the time. I want people who are representatives who will go and represent my views and my concerns and the concerns of every other citizen in government. And that's what this is. If democracy actually works, and it is an issue that the people want to have dealt with, then their representatives going and negotiating these schemes out on our behalf is democratic. Now, the fourth point that they go after, carbon offsets reduce the need for our government to give us a different set of choices. A better solution would be an amalgam of action ranging from local movement to a national government investment program to appropriate technology. I understand this concern. There's a worry that governments will introduce cap and trade and then walk away, having washed their hands of that pesky global warming problem. I share that same worry, particularly in relation to the United States. My only response can be, it hasn't happened before. Take the European Union, for example. EU countries are party to the EU ETS and theoretically are in a position to let the market deal with climate change. But in actuality, Europe is leading the way in investment in renewable energy and incentives for carbon reduction. In other words, the cap-and-trade system has not had the effect we fear. You just have to look at the things that Germany has done. Germany is doing amazing things in converting their baseload power generation to green sources. I mean, they've got more solar per capita in Germany than we have here in Australia, which is still just a thought that makes me want to go and shove my head through a wall. And ELO asks in the chat room, is it meant to be a permanent thing or just something to ease the amount of carbon released until we can move away from carbon-based fuels altogether? If they reduce emissions, will they just become comfortable with that? This is all just a launching point, if that makes sense. We have to start somewhere and create an incentive system for business. Now, we've seen really good business leadership in this country actually saying, yes, get the system going, because until you give us the price for carbon, we don't know how much to invest in what and over what kind of time frame. So it's to create a mechanism. And, you know, I think that if you go over your quota, you need to be financially penalized and still be held accountable for future reductions. So, for all its failings in the EU, for all its imperfections, it actually has had positive benefit already. It's not what we want to see in the long run, and I think that this is a problem that we face all over the world. Our outlook is too short-sighted when it comes to these things. I mean, that's been the key problem why we hadn't been dealing with this issue since the 1970s. You know, we kept thinking about the profits just that year and not worrying about the damage being done. This, I do think that this is crucial. And to get people on board, and some of them you're going to have to drag kicking and screaming. Now there's, on that line, one of the other articles in this three, like I said, these are really great reference points on the subject, and I'm not reading the whole things. So check the links from today's show post, and you can read them yourself. And there's other links from there. If you go to the Helium article, there's a couple of other related articles that you can go and read. And this again, this is something that no one has the definitive answer to, but this seems like it is one of the best possible ways to try and, using a very, very, you know, scary term here, regulate emissions. And every year, the reduction targets need to become stiffer and stiffer and stiffer and stiffer and stiffer. And if you fall behind, it's going to cost you, baby. And just like, you know, in the green building article that I was discussing yesterday, they've, you know, kind of the rule of thumb is for every dollar spent in efficiency, you get $4 in savings down the road. Now, any investment broker would tell you that that's a pretty bloody good investment. But we have to think in the long term. Now, this other article, does cap and trade reward big polluters? We've had some, it has caused that in some instances, hence why we need to tweak and fix and adjust, you know, bob and weave and figure it out. And Susan's exactly right in the chat room. You know, it gives the impression that it would be really easy for industry to become complacent. But that's why every year the reductions have to become stiffer. Then they're not allowed to become complacent. And hey, if you end up being able to reduce your emissions by more than the goal in a particular year, I think in some way you should be, you know, thanked for it. How you do that, I don't know. But it has to be developed to a point where we don't allow them to become complacent. Because, I mean, that's all that we've had is it's been complacency over the decades that has allowed us to get into this awful situation that we're in now. Now, again, this is from January this year. So, you know, does cap and trade reward big polluters? Short answer, sometimes. See, none of this is black and white. None of this is right or wrong. This is something that is developing and needs to be constantly adjusted, tweaked, and improved. The Independent reported that the UK's biggest polluters would reap over $6 billion in windfall profits from the EU ETS. This is up from the £1 billion predicted by BBC News in May of 2006. In other words, the companies that pollute the most are making billions off a system designed to reduce their emissions. Seems a bit counterproductive, no? In truth, that is exactly that. Emissions trading can be great. No other market mechanism, save the unpopular carbon tax, can efficiently internalize the true cost of greenhouse gas emissions to our economy. But the design of the system and the finesse of its creators can make or break its effectiveness. And a poorly designed cap-and-trade scheme can effectively have a reverse effect. And see, I think it has to be not just carbon trade and cap, but I think there does need to be a tax. These costs need to be internalized by those who do the damage. Bottom line. Bottom line. Bottom line. And maybe decades down the road, it'll get to the point where you have to pay out hard for anything that goes past being completely carbon neutral. Because for every dollar that you make with degradation to the overall climate, you haven't actually paid the cost of whatever it is that you make. You're getting something for free. You're stealing from the rest of us. Or we're stealing from ourselves, all depending on how you want to look at it. Now, the author here, whose name I will get, this is Shale Khan. Let me explain. When a cap-and-trade system is introduced, the effective members of it industry, the major polluters, each retain a particular number of allowances, which represents the amount of greenhouse gas emissions they are allowed that year. If a polluter emits less than the number of allowances it holds, it can sell the excess allowances to other polluters who emit more than their share. However, one of the primary questions in designing a cap-and-trade system is how to get the allowances in the hands of polluters. Do you give them allowances based on, for example, their historic emissions, or do you hold an auction and force polluters to purchase as many offsets as they deem necessary? And I reckon it's probably got to be a bit of a combination of the two. You make, you know, when you begin these systems, yeah, you have to use their recent history to come up with your benchmark. But I think from the beginning of that, from the beginning of the system, you have to say that, okay, before next year, you have to reduce your emissions by this much, or you're not allowed to increase them, no matter how much more business you do. And if you increase them, pay out. Pay out. I don't necessarily like the idea that if you do come in under quota, that you can sell your credits to somebody else. That, I think, brings in some inherent problems. Especially if the cap that you've been given to start with is way too high, which I think relates to the question that ELO was posing in the chat room. This is again, a very, very, very complex subject. It's something that no one has the answer to right now. ELO keeps chiming in the chat room, and it's all wonderful points. But would they be able to tie up fines in courts for years like Exxon has with the Valdez? And it's a damn good question, ELO. Now, I think it would have to tie into their ability to do business. Period. And it's all right, ELO. You know, I mean, this subject was brought up by request in the chat room. So, I mean, it's because you all wanted to hit on this, and I think, and you know, I love you guys for this. This could be one of the most significant mechanisms to making real change, but it can't be so watered down that it becomes just another way for the worst to make more money. It has to be, and you know, I don't have the answers to this. I really don't. This is something. It'll be interesting now that Australia has actually signed on to the Kyoto Protocol, as opposed to just sitting on the sidelines and watching what goes on. We actually have a seat at the table. And I think Penny Wong and Peter Garrett and the rest of the New Labour government are going to be very active participants in Kyoto. And one of the things, you know, and what here's just an example of how complex it can get. Okay, coal company here in Australia that digs it out of the ground. When you calculate their carbon quota, do you do it on the carbon that they produce in mining and transporting the coal? Or do you also include the carbon that will be created when it's burned over in China? My answer is yes. You cannot externalize these costs anymore. I think that this is the crucial mechanism that a carbon trade system needs to be applied to. You have to be looking at the entire chain. And just because you only dug it out of the ground and someone else is burning it doesn't mean that you're not responsible for the end result of what you do. So this is very, very complicated. And this is where it's going to be the most unique global coordinated effort, I think, in modern world history. And it's going to be hard. And at times it is going to hurt here and there. But again, it's like that thing. $1 invested is, you know, $4 in savings down the road. The bit of hurt now is going to save a whole hell of a lot of pain in comparison down the road. And we had a thing sometime last year where a permit for a new coal mine, or it might have been it was a coal mine, here in Australia was turned down because the judge decided that the impact of the burning of the coal in China had to be included in the environmental impact statement. Kind of similar to what we've seen happen with some permits in the United States, in Texas and Kansas and whatnot, where they're saying, you know, you say that these new plants will be clean coal ready for whenever the technology is working. That's not good enough. Get the technology working first. The technology has to come first. Otherwise, no permit. Get it from pipe dream, crack pipe technology to something real, then we'll talk. And that's where I think, you know, it has to be a carbon cap, and the trade part, I think, is where the whole is created for abuse and for it to have the opposite effect of what we want. I think that part of it has to be a carbon tax, that for every ton of carbon that you produce, you need to be paying X number of dollars, and it has to be calculated out into real dollar value of what damage that amount of carbon actually does to the planet. So, and that carbon tax then can be used to help build solar geothermal plants can be used for, you know, incentives for people to put solar panels on their homes, or even help, even go back into helping those very same industries to improve their standard. So if the new technology is a bit more expensive, well, you've been paying, here we go, here's a very globally socialistic idea. You've been paying this tax for the damage you do. But that same tax you've been paying is going to come back to you in incentives and help on cleaning up your own act. I think that might be where we really need to be getting with this. Yeah, and it might create a job or two. This is the part that, you know, it's just like, you know, Barack Obama is a Muslim. Seems to be this false, you know, wishful facting that is very similar to, you know, going green is going to cost jobs. No, it's going to create new jobs. It's going to create a lot of new jobs. But I think in the long term, we're so scared of change and, to be perfectly honest, freaking lazy and loving really, really cheap, dirty fuel to fuel our society, that the idea of changing at all, you know, we've been doing this for years. What are you doing telling me I got to do it different? Well, because what you've been doing for years is actually killing you. And I want to help you stop killing yourself and me and my son and my missus and my neighbors. And you complain about the cost of health care. Guess what? Clean up your act. Overall health care costs will come down. But then again, I must be insane. No, I'm not. but I mean, we're seeing that, you know, even in the United States. I mean, I love that bit about the green homes yesterday. You know, even in the United States, where the market is king, the housing, you know, the deflation of the housing market is pretty well across the board, except for green housing. Explain that if you think that being clean green is not economically sound. How can you explain that? You can't. Because when you're talking about people spending a few more $1,000s on a home in a tight market, you can't tell me that it's all because it's a fad. It's all just very, very popular right now and everybody's doing it. But I mean, it is such a complex subject, and I just, you know, I hope and I wait for the day when the United States actually signs on to Kyoto, faults or not, and gets with the program and starts working with the rest of the planet on dealing with the most important issue of our time. And you know, we start doing things like this, we won't have to fight wars for resources. You know, there's a lot of talk about how global warming is actually a national security issue. Lottie says in the chat room, only rich people have money to buy homes, and they are buying green homes. I'll accept that. I will accept that. But then again, there is also we don't hear much about it. There's a huge resurgence of people who are actually building their own homes green. Cob building. Other things. No, I mean, you're absolutely right. You know, in general, people that can afford to feel better about themselves do it. But there's also a thing that, you know, we're finding, you know, if you use natural materials to build your home, it can be really, really cheap to build your home. I know people that we've got this great book here on natural building, and where families have built their own homes for only $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000, $8,000 on top of the land, and they, you know, mom, dad, and the kids go and get all dirty in the mud and build their own house. I mean, what an amazing family bonding experience would that be, to build your own home? And we are seeing more of that happen. So it does happen on the other side, and then there's the issue, what do we do with the homes that are already built? Damn good question. I think we deal with new construction first. And like I was talking about yesterday, you have, you know, things like Austin Power in Austin, Texas, who have an amazing, amazing seeming incentive program to get people to invest in solar panels because it's good for their business. So, you know, then we have to work on retrofitting. And, you know, solar technology is making great leaps and bounds, and, you know, it's, you can find, no matter what I'm going to say, you can find holes to poke in it, but it doesn't change the fact that things need to be done, and it's every little bit that we can do that will make a difference. But we all have to be involved. So, okay, you're not building a new eco-friendly home. Well, there are other things that you do. You be as efficient as possible. You know, I've said before, if you haven't changed all of your major lighting over into compact fluorescence at the moment, you're throwing money away. And it actually does make a difference. If you can cut your electrical consumption by 25% per month, and everyone does that, that makes a real dent. So if it ends up being that electricity, you know, goes up 25%, like we've voluntarily done here, it's offset. You've just offset it by efficiency. So it's a massive thing. It's so huge. And I mean, and there is no one answer. There is no one answer. But one thing we got to stop doing is building the crappy, inefficient, non-green way that we have been. And, you know, you can build great, you know, heating systems in, you know, underfloor heating systems, incredibly efficient. You know, there's just, you know, the options are endless. We just need to learn what they are. But I do believe we're coming up on the end of things here, so we're going to have to wrap it up here. So thanks for listening again today, folks. Thanks to Bob Kincaid for producing the program. Thanks to ELO and the bloggers and everybody who makes this just such a wonderful place to broadcast from. Thanks to Scott Berry at B1 Ladder Productions for the music. And as we say here on Foxed Up, be good, be green. We'll see you tomorrow.
And the sign said, long-haired freaky people need not apply. So I tucked my hair up under my hat, and I went in to ask him why.